I'm Judy Hecker, an assistant curator in the Department of Prints and Illustrated Books at MoMA, and I was one of the co-curators of the MoMA presentation of the William Kentridge exhibitions here. Just so I can get a sense of how many of you have seen the exhibition, can I see a show of hands? Okay, so pretty much everybody, yes? And if you haven't, you certainly will. You'll want to after this, hopefully. So the exhibition, just a little bit of background. What we're showing is a variation of a touring exhibition. The show was originally curated for SF MoMA, and it's traveled throughout the country, and we're the last national venue it's going to go on. Another version of it will travel on to Europe, I think to 5 venues there. The timing of the show, some of you may know that William Kentridge premiered his third opera, The Nose, at the Metropolitan Opera just a few weeks ago. Did any of you catch that? Okay, terrific, wonderful, some of you. From what I understand, they're going to be bringing it back because it's sold out. The Met had only, I think, 5 runs after the premiere, and they were unsure how it would sell, but it sold out, and so they're going to bring it back. I'm not sure when, but there'll be opportunity to see it again. So the exhibition that you see upstairs here on our second floor, it's our largest exhibition space at the museum, which was a complete delight to work with as a curator, particularly with an artist who has done such large-scale projects. So what you see upstairs is a version of what traveled. We added a great number of works from MoMA's collection. So the difference is that it's been an expanded. We edited down the show a little bit and added many, many collection works, and of course gave it, I think, the most space that it's had in its among its venues in the United States, which means we were able to show things with just great amounts of space to both accommodate our crowds and also to give the individual works a nice amount of breathing room. Just a little bit about MoMA and William Kentridge. We have been collecting his work for over 10 years. The first acquisition came through the print department, a set of prints, which is where I started in on the story of Kentridge. Later in the 90s, we had a projects exhibition with him and also a site-specific project out at PS1, which is still in their stairwell. If you ever head out to PS1, you can find that. And over the years, we've collected something on the order of nearly 80 or 80 plus works, including prints, including drawings, including his film animations and some of his large sculptural maquettes for theater. So we've got really quite an important concentration of works. And so with the exhibition coming to the East Coast, we really wanted to show off what we have in the collection. So as you go around, you'll notice many of the collection labels. See here. Okay, we've covered that. These are the 5 themes. The 5 themes were organized here somewhat chronologically. In other venues, they were presented in different ways. And these 5 themes are 5 bodies of work that inform the artist's practice. There are some other themes that are altogether absent. There are so many different ways to slice through his work. And Mark Rosenthal, the organizing curator, had organized it along with the artist, to these 5 key themes. And the reason we have them shown in kind of 3 sections is because the flow of the exhibition is really in 3 sections. This is the second floor. I'll give you a little orientation. Well, I'll just walk over. Well, can you hear me like this or no?
Yeah.
So this is the atrium where Marina Abramović is now. This is the entrance, the front entrance. This is the back entrance. This isn't the exact floor plan because there's a wall here that's missing. But essentially, it's a giant H with the right side of the H here, the middle of the H here, and the left side of the H here. This is not part of the show. This is where we have a project from the project series now. But in thinking about the design of the exhibition, we wanted to take advantage. I'll go back to the microphone. We wanted to take advantage of the soaring ceiling heights, the long views that would be possible. And every time we show an exhibition in the space, the walls change to different degrees. We, because of budgetary restrictions, we always have to use some of the walls. We can't completely start with a clean slate every time. So we were able to use some of the existing walls, add other walls. And what we wanted to do was create these long views into rooms that would contain his moving images, his film animations, which is what he's most known for. So for instance, when you first enter, you have this very dramatic view this way of a moving image. When you turn the corner, you have a very even more dramatic image of the largest of the moving images, and so on. And then large spaces devoted to his video installations in the round here. And then the two theater pieces. So one of the organizing principles were these sort of long, dramatic views. In fact, the size of the film projections here are larger than they've ever been shown indoors. They've been shown large outside in Prospect Park and also in Central Park, but it's the largest that they've been shown indoors. And for instance, here you see one of these great long views. And so one of the challenges of the exhibition, I worked with two curators who are from the Department of Media, which is our video department. And so one of the challenges was how to show works on very different scales, very different mediums, and still have them make sense. And so in the end, I think it actually, and hopefully as viewers you've had this experience, that the big shifts in scale that you get when you see a large moving image, as you see on the right side here, a still from one of his film animations, and then you see a smaller drawing or even smaller prints related, the shift in scale helps you understand his work. It helps bring it down to a human scale. And I think it gives, allows the space to sort of, let's see, this is one of the other, this is a, not a very good shot, taken off of Facebook, actually, of the entrance of the gallery. And so the other thing that we wanted to convey with this shift in scale and the different mediums is really all the different mediums that the artist himself works in. Oftentimes when we have a monographic exhibition at MoMA by a particular artist, we may emphasize his painting, or perhaps his painting, his or her paintings and drawings. But here, because Kentridge works in so many different mediums, many different printmaking mediums, drawing, film animation, theater, and the performing arts, we wanted to give a sense of all the different disciplines that comprise his work. And so even from the first gallery, you see the tone is set in that you see a moving image straight ahead. On the right, you see three large drawings, and then off to the left on the perpendicular wall, you see a set of prints. So immediately you get a sense of there are a lot of things going on here, but hopefully not too many things, which is why we wanted the installation, and it's hard in a way, I wish I was walking you through the exhibition, to have these quieter moments where you'll just see, let's say, a long sequence of prints and nothing else on the wall. And that was a way I had hoped, and you'll let me know if it works, to give a kind of visual pause and a quieter moment apart from the moving images. And so these different types, these different modes of viewing was something that informed the installation and something that we really worked on together as we physically installed the objects. And so as I mentioned, there are five themes. The first is Ubu and the procession. Ubu is short for Ubu Tells the Truth, which is a body of work that the artist developed in the mid-90s, shortly after South Africa's first non-racial democratic election in 1994. It was also the 100th anniversary of a French playwright's performance of a play called Ubu Ra, or King Ubu, by Alfred Jarry. You may have heard of him. He's a French satirical playwright from the late 1900s, early from the 19th century. And Kentridge was particularly interested in this idea of using Ubu, who was first cast by Alfred Jarry as a kind of despot, an absurd figure, a figure that was despised and sort of represented all of the ugliness of humanity. And so he wanted to see how he could resurrect this idea of Ubu on the 100th anniversary and just following the democratic election as a kind of metaphor for apartheid itself. Ubu tells the truth. Truth, that word comes from very explicitly from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings that were being that took place throughout South Africa. Again, shortly after the election, the government came together, the post-apartheid government came together and brought both the perpetrators and the victims of apartheid side by side to come to terms with the atrocities that had happened over the last several decades. And so Kentridge began thinking about Ubu in this way, and so you can see how he has actually used Alfred Jarry's figure of Ubu with this rotund, spiral belly and a pointy head, which if you look at the original material is almost a direct quotation of Jarry, but he superimposed it over this human counterpart, which sort of represents and looks like a more textured portrayal of human experience. It's a set actually of eight etchings and aquatints that you see as you first enter the gallery. And this tipped off what became a much larger project. As you can see, even in just these four examples, Kentridge was already thinking in a kind of narrative, theatrical way, even though he hadn't anticipated doing a live theatrical performance. So here you see Act 1, Scene 9, Act 4, Scene 7, and so on. These are actually fictional act and scene numbers, and there's no particular order, but in fact the set did give rise to a live theatrical performance also called Ubu Tells the Truth, and it was based even more explicitly on the TRC hearings, and it used actual dialogue from some of the hearings that took place between both sides of the apartheid situation. This is, so for me as a print curator, what was particularly interesting is the fact that this whole series started out with a series of small etchings. And so oftentimes with Kentridge's practice, etchings will give rise to a theater piece or drawings that'll give rise to an animation, and then he'll circle back to printmaking. So he really uses all of these different mediums to help build his vocabulary, tease out his ideas about a certain subject. Each brings a different kind of expression to the subject. After this particular etching set, he created a live film animation, which hopefully you've seen upstairs. This is just four stills from it. Where again he used white chalk line drawing, also collage. It's a narrative exploration of violence, and there's also a moment where an Ubu character comes out as live action performance. This is what's exciting about this exhibition, about this format rather than a walkthrough. This is the live theatrical performance that came from the etchings, and you can see he used this idea of white chalk moving images in the back and figures in the front. And that relates to that idea that was first presented in the series of etchings where you see sort of Ubu in the background and then the human counterpart. So he used this idea of layering that he began in the etchings also in the live theatrical performance that followed. And what's projected in the background is, in fact, this piece that you'll see, this moving image, this moving film animation that you'll see in the galleries. The other work that you'll see is Shadow Procession. And this was also done in the 90s. It grew out of the Ubu project. And it's one of Kentridge's other ways of working, which is with collage. A lot of his animations are based on drawn images. And I don't know if any of you have a full understanding yet of how he actually makes his animations, but and you can see it if you go to, we might have time today, if not, when you're home, I recommend going to moma.org/William Kentridge, because we've produced a number of video clips that actually show the artist at work in his studio, that show him making animations. But essentially, when he makes an animation, he'll pin a piece of paper on the wall, he'll take charcoal to it, occasionally pastel, and create an image. He really does it through improvisation. He doesn't have a storyboard in mind, and he'll keep adding to the image, and each time he adds to the image or erases or wipes certain details away from the image, he'll step back and photograph the work. He'll approach the drawing again, make a change, and step back and photograph the work. And so all once, and he does this with a 35mm, 16mm camera, and once he's completed all of the photographs and all of the drawings, then he puts them together and makes an animation. And so in a way, it's the opposite of Pixar, where there's a particular thousands or millions, I don't know how many, of images that are created for each particular movement. Instead, Kentridge will work with a small set of drawings and create changes in each of them, and then photograph those over and over again. Does that make sense? It's been referred to as Stone Age animation, which I think captures what it is. It's the complete opposite of Avatar. And so he also has done this with collage. He's torn collaged figures out of black paper and fashioned different objects and moving figures out of them, and then he'll photograph it. Then he'll move them a little and photograph. And so you get this wonderful kind of moving procession. And here's a series. It's hard to represent these in still images, but I think you get a sense of the movement and the kind of sort of raw imagery, crude imagery, that's very, very evocative. Kentridge's work isn't overtly political. There's no question there's a political component to it. He's from South Africa. He grew up during apartheid. His parents were very politically engaged. Both of them were prominent lawyers in South Africa. His father in particular was involved in a lot of civil rights cases, represented Steve Biko's family and Nelson Mandela and other prisoners. And so Kentridge had a very clear awareness growing up and that something was very wrong with the world around him. He would sometimes come across at a very young age of pictures of evidence that his father would use in his cases. So there were images of dead bodies and violence that he was exposed to. And so there's no question that the work references apartheid, but the work isn't overtly political, as a lot of work that you find out there is today and throughout the ages. And instead, he's more interested in nuance and metaphor and associations. So again, what you'll see, they're open stories, they're quasi-narratives, they're suggestive, they're evocative, and you're meant to bring your own associations to what you're seeing. And so when you go into the exhibition, you need to keep that kind of open mind about what he's showing you. In fact, this theme of the procession is based in this idea of black communities that were uprooted during apartheid in the name of political and economic advancement, and they would have to vacate their homes would be leveled, and they'd have to just take all of their belongings, whatever they could grab, and carry it and sort of run and relocate. And so this idea of carrying what you, all your possessions on your back, on your head, as some of these figures actually morph into objects themselves. That's one of the themes. So clearly it's related to South African experience, but it has to do with immigrants worldwide, displacement, wherever you find it, in Haiti. So the reach is much, much more global, which is, I think, what continues to make his work so relevant. Forgive the bottom part of this image is irrelevant. It's just has to do with how it was imaged. But what we're seeing here is a long accordion folded format. This is, I think, an exquisite moment in the exhibition. I don't have an installation shot of it, but you'll recall that this is in a vitrine, and it's shown as an extended unfolded book. And it's placed there to give an example of, again, the different formats in which he applies and uses his vocabulary. So here you see, I'll show you, this is a close-up with the book actually flattened. And so you can see a book that he fashioned out of torn paper collage, similar to the moving images that he made. And again, just teasing out the effects of using these ideas and subjects in different formats. What he's done here is something that he does in a lot of his work, which is to actually collage on or draw on to unbound pages from encyclopedias, ledgers, dictionaries of all different languages. And so he uses it and again, not a very literal way. Sometimes there's a correlation between his imagery and the encyclopedia, but it's also about just loose associations and just providing a little bit more texture and sense of history to the work itself. These are two grand linoleum cuts that we added to the exhibition at MoMA. If you recall, these are just to the left of the small portage. And what he's done here is experimented with scale again. Instead of having these sort of 8-inch processional figures on the book, he's blown them up to life size. He was working on another theatrical project called Zeno at 4 a.m., in which he experimented with life-scale projections and shadow processions, and this work came out at the time. He was actually invited to participate in an exhibition where contemporary artists were commissioned to create life-scale self-portraits using linoleum cut, and so he came up with one of these images. So part serendipity, part his own experimentation. These are exquisite black and white linoleum cuts, a medium that he has not worked in very often. When you see these in person, you can see the exquisite black and white line work and patterning that's characteristic of the medium. Linoleum cut is actually used very widely in South Africa. It's a cost-effective, easy way to create prints. You don't need a specialized printer, etching press, chemicals, and so it's a popular means of making imagery. He collaborated with the master linoleum cutter to create these exquisite images. If you have any questions as we go along, I'm happy to make this more of a conversational format rather than a lecture, so please feel free to interrupt me with questions about particular works or the way they're installed. Yeah. I don't think there was any copying going on. I mean, there's no question. A lot of people have talked about the relationship between their work in terms of the shadow procession, the silhouette, the torn black paper. I think that they're most certainly aware of each other's work. I don't think either informed the other. I think it's just a very interesting kind of coincidence in a way. I think Kara Walker deals much more explicitly with stereotypes of race in her community in a way that Kentridge doesn't deal with it. I think his are a little bit more diffuse and universal in their meaning, where Kara Walker is conveying a particular moment in antebellum, the Civil War South. But there's no question that you're not the first one to comment on that kind of correlation.
Any other questions?
Nope. Okay.
Can you tell us some more about this center image and the objects that are...
Yeah, this is from one of his... This is actually an installation shot of the exhibition out in San Francisco at SF MoMA, and you can see also how they paired drawings side by side with moving images. And so in the center, I'm not exactly sure which... film it's from. I'll say just a little bit about the 9 drawings for projection. So in 1989, actually before he did Shadow Procession in the Ubu set, he started what became known as his seminal body of work called 9 Drawings for Projection. They went from 1989 to 2007. He didn't set out to make 9, but that's just the body of work that it became. And these are animations that are based solely on his drawings. And so again, it would be this method of creating charcoal drawings, erasing, adding, altering each one, and then filming them along the way. The first one is called Johannesburg, Second Greatest City After Paris, so there's a lot of satire. One thing you should note also in his work, there's a lot of humor, a lot of satire. He touches on very serious social and political subject matter, but always with a kind of edge to it and a wit that brings a bit of comic bits of relief. I'm not sure which film this one recalls, but the megaphone is a prominent metaphor in his work and has been since the beginning. You'll see the figure on the left. This drawing is in the exhibition upstairs. It's a man nude gazing down into a megaphone. And the artist has commented on megaphones as a sort of symbol for what's what can be heard outside of oneself, perhaps representing the larger society, maybe what people weren't saying about apartheid that needed to be said. A lot of what you'll see in his work are these sort of outmoded modes of communication, rotary telephones, old Bakelite telephones, typewriters, ticker tape machines, megaphones. And so a lot of these modes of communication are from a kind of bygone era. There are no cell phones or computers in the work. And so that's a landscape that has megaphones in it. This is a still from his first drawing for projection. So it's actually a drawing in charcoal with little bits of pastel in it. And what you see here, the whole nine drawings for projection centers around a loose narrative about two characters, Soho Eckstein and Felix Teitelbaum, and then Mrs. Eckstein also factors into the storyline. And Soho Eckstein is always pictured in a pinstripe suit. Kentridge had memories of his grandfather always dressing in pinstripe suits. Even when he went to the beach, he was in pinstripe suits. Soho Eckstein is a real here. His grandfather wasn't, but Soho Eckstein is a vulgar kind of a figure that represents the ugly side of apartheid South Africa. He's a mine owner, real estate developer, and he's a glutton. And you can see in this scene, I don't know if you recall the moving image, he just sort of stuffs his face with food and everything, and then burps and does all these vile things, and some of the food ends up being spit out onto a procession of miners, of workers. And some of these films also juxtapose Soho Eckstein's successful life and his business headquarters over and against life underground, the daily life of what it's like to be a miner working underground. And so you can see it's also interesting to see kind of how loose and crude Kentridge's drawing style is. Later on, the work becomes a little bit more refined. Let's see what other stills we have here. This is, again, an earlier work from 1990, Monument, where Soho Eckstein erects a kind of civic monument. He's a kind of benefactor, but in fact, the monument, when it's unveiled, is a shackled man who is carrying a load on his back. And here's a scene from Mine, which focuses on the life of miners underground. And this is a work from 91 called Sobriety, Obesity, and Growing Old, again, wit and humor. The works, even though they're very much about Soho Eckstein on the one hand and what he represents, and Felix Teitelbaum on the other hand, Felix is a kind of alter ego for Soho Eckstein. He's always pictured without clothing, so you can clearly see who you're looking at. Felix Teitelbaum is a kind of free spirit. He's a poet. He's an artist. He's a kinder, gentler being. And Mrs. Eckstein sort of bounces back between both men. Sobriety, Preceding Growing Old, has a lot of tender and emotional moments in it. At this point, I think, in the film, Mrs. Eckstein has left Soho, and so there's this very poignant statement, which is also a drawing that we've shown in the exhibition called, it says, Her Absence Filled the World. And this is a rendering of Felix. So again, no clothing. At this moment in the whole series, Felix in Exile is the title of this film. Felix has been sort of exiled to a hotel room. Mr. and Mrs. Eckstein have gotten back together, and Felix is on his own. He starts to explore in his imagination the landscape. He meets a woman named Nandi. He explores his work as an artist. Pictures float off the wall. And he sees a lot of... Yeah?
Oh, most of these images are in his own image. Is he talking about?
Right. So a lot of... It's interesting. Even as soon as you walk into the exhibition, You can see on the right the series of three what look like self-portraits. They're really not intended to be self-portraits, but they're part of the Ubu set of work. He's never employed a model in his studio. More recently, he's employed people as collaborators in his work, but early on, he never knew how long he would need a model for, what he would want the model to do, and so he started instead to use his own body as a kind of model by looking into mirrors and recording what he saw on paper, photographing himself, and then using that as source material for his work. So there's no question that his own likeness appears throughout the work. But again, they're not overt self-portraits. There is a section in the exhibition where he does deal with self-portraiture, and we'll get to that in a moment. A lot of what you see does look like him now, but was more based on images of his own grandfather at that stage. But now, of course, he's beginning to look more and more like his grandfather. So yes, it really is his likeness. And Soho, Eckstein, and Felix Teitelbaum are clearly sort of the same person, just two different embodiments. Yes? Yeah, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people have brought that up because clearly Soho, Eckstein, Felix Teitelbaum are Jewish names. And this point has come up and people have asked him. And in fact, it's more about making art about what he knows. In fact, there's a very, very large Jewish population in South Africa. I mean, they started coming during the Tsarists and during the pogroms, and there's a great body of literature, which I hope to dive into a bit more about the Lithuanian immigrants into South Africa, and they were responsible for helping to make Johannesburg. They came for the mining, the gold, the diamonds, and a lot of them were prominent civic leaders, government leaders. Of course, there's also the fact that a lot of them became successful because of apartheid, and they had a lot of colored and black people working for them, so there's that aspect, which was true of all white people in society at that time. On the other hand, a lot of the Jews were very liberal and progressive, having gone through what the Jewish people have gone through historically. They sort of associated with the slave mentality of apartheid and were voices for change. And in fact, Kentridge's own family were political activists. And Kentridge talks about how it was always so ironic in his household during a Passover Seder talking about the slaves when in fact there are people and their freedom, when in fact they're living in a society where people were enslaved. But back to your original question, Eckstein, he said, is an incredibly popular name in Johannesburg, and in fact, there are street signs called Eckstein. Teitelbaum, that name came to him in a dream, so it was more of an imagined thing. I don't think he set out to make these characters explicitly Jewish. Clearly, they are, and a lot has been read into that. If he was Afrikaans, I think they would have had Afrikaans names. If he was black, they would have had you know, again, different names. So I don't think he's making a particular statement about Jews in South Africa. I think he's just, it's what he knows. And I think, again, it's both those sides. I mean, Teitelbaum is more of a sympathetic character. Eckstein is less sympathetic. You know, two sides of what's going on, of what went on there. But again, the same could be said. Two Afrikaans names could have been used, and the same statement could have been said. I you know, it's hard. Yes.
Does the title Nine Drawings for Projection relate back to that process you were describing? Is it nine drawings that form the foundation?
Exactly. Nine Drawings for Projection that's his process in a nutshell. So again, it's not, there weren't just nine drawings that comprised this whole series, but rather several drawings that comprised what became nine. Film projections, but yes, it referred, instead of calling them nine films, he wanted to really, I think, convey the means of making these. So it's they're drawings for projection. It's his Stone Age animation. They're not nine films. So I don't know if that answers your question. A lot of people have read into his use of those names in different ways, particularly in New York, where there's you know, a prominent Jew. Yeah. So I think you'll just have to draw your own conclusions on that, but no, he's not anti-Semitic.
I think that there's some self-loathing there because your family was very liberal.
Well, that's what I said. Yes, exactly. And I think there are a lot of self-loathing South Africans out there, no question. And I think you know, most of us would be also. There's no question that he's dealing with the fact, and he's been very outspoken with the fact that he grew up a very privileged existence, and he became the kind of successful artist that he did, I think, because he does have the talent, but he had the opportunity that black artists didn't. And so he's completely self-aware and the first to admit that he's coming from a privileged position. And again, this history of The Main Complaint, one of the later films where Soho Eckstein goes through medical problems, and that this whole parade of doctors around him become figures of Soho Eckstein also. This is a work in the collection. It's a still from one of his later films called Stereoscope. Kentridge has been always interested in optics and the mechanics of optics, quite literally and also metaphorically. And so in this work, drawing for Stereoscope, he started to address this notion of double vision, which is a theme throughout his work, the duality, Soho Felix, alter egos. And again, Stereoscope is a literal manifestation of double vision. Stereopticon is a device where you look at two flat images in a device that enables you to pull those images together and see them in three dimensions. And in later work, he actually deals with the devices themselves, but in this early piece, he deals with the stereoscope as a kind of metaphor. And throughout the film animation, you often see a scene bisected by a blue line, and I think you can see it kind of coming out of Soho Eckstein's head here, and so you get this kind of double imagery in that particular film. Well, it does, sure. It looks like a noose around his neck. It looks, is he dying? Is he crying? Blue, I'll also mention, that's again the kind of open interpretation that his work invites and that he encourages. Blue is really the only color that ever appears in his work, sometimes lines, red lines as well. He started out, and I should say a bit more, I should have said this at the beginning. Kentridge is a theater guy. He started out in theater. He studied mime, theater. He also studied painting. He had trouble with painting because he didn't know quite how to handle all the color that was involved in painting, and so he gravitated towards etching. And that's when he became very involved in printmaking. He was drawn to the etched line because it enabled himself from using color. And so, in fact, the etched line, the black line, was something he embraced. And from that, he moved into charcoal, black and white drawings, and into film animation. But blue is the one color that you do see, and I think it's shown as water, it's shown as tears, it's sort of a life force. Oftentimes, you see small fish flipping around in the water. And again, self-portraiture. This is another example in MoMA's collection that you can see upstairs. It's himself. Is it a self-portrait? Is it Soho Eckstein? And that's Anne, his wife, on the left. Excuse me. Anne is the other model that he uses in his studio. And so you'll see her likeness in a lot of the works, and you'll actually see her in some of the works in video also. But a really poignant piece, I think. Again, charcoal over unbound pages. It's a terrible, terrible reproduction, but you can see it upstairs. So we've just moved through the second theme, Soho and Felix, in the exhibition. The third theme is the artist in the studio, where he starts looking more self-consciously at what it's like to be an artist, working with models in the studio. This is a more traditional self-portrait, although again, layered on top of unbound pages. He often wears that hat, and so this one really is a self-portrait. You see other works. This is when you're in the exhibition in the kind of middle of the H, and you see a lot of drawings. There are renderings of the artist and model in the studio. I like to show this because this is the earliest work in the exhibition. It's from 1979, and it's a monotype, a black and white monotype. His first exhibition as a visual artist was a whole series of monotypes called Pit. And it explores this idea of the pit of the theater, the pit of the orchestra, but again, and the blackness, and you can see the onlookers above. But again, you start to see that he's thinking like an artist, as you can see this nude man painting or drawing renderings of the model there. It's just such an interesting work to me. It's small, it's intimate. Again, a monotype is he inked up with black ink a plexiglass or other surface and then printed off of it, so no color. He used thumbprints in this work, and again, very evocative of the theater, theatricality, but also the artist in the studio. And then, again, in that H, on the other side of that hallway where all these drawings are, is this magical space called Seven Fragments for George. And I see we have a spelling error. Meles. It's a series, and you've probably all spent time in this. If you haven't, you should spend a good amount of time in it. It actually combines three different films. One film has seven pieces to it, so these you see four of them here. There are three on the opposing wall, so this is a big rectangular room. And then the other at the far end, the larger image, is Journey to the Moon, and on the other side is Day for Night. So it's three projects that are often shown together but don't have to be shown together. The museum happens to own this entire series, and it's all about the artist in the studio. So here he is very explicitly inserting his own likeness into his work, whereas you saw renderings of figures that appear to be like him, appear to be like family members. This is him, and he becomes the subject of his work, and specifically what it's like to be an artist in his studio. And you see him pacing in the studio, walking back and forth. You see the kind of time just before he starts to make images. You see him making images. What's most interesting, this is an homage to George Meles, who was a pioneer in cinematic special effects in the late 19th, early 20th century. And have any of you ever seen his work? Yeah, okay. And Journey to the Moon is a famous piece where you take a journey to the moon, and a rocket ship goes off to the moon and runs into the eye of the moon. You can see all of this online if you haven't seen it elsewhere. And so it's a kind of homage to this early filmmaker who uses cinematic tricks, who uses reversals. Kentridge has, in fact, started to use, in this work, you'll see things don't seem quite right when you're watching the artist at work. Much of what's shown is shown in reverse. There's stop-motion animation, so there's a lot of special effects and trickery used by the artist, as was used early on. And so it's a space that I hope you'll spend some time in, and you'll see him creating images, you'll see him creating collage. Journey to the Moon is the only work that has an explicit narrative to it. It's the only one that also has music. But the room is filled, as with, and we haven't talked about music, but each of his film animations is accompanied by an audio. So soundtrack is an important part of all of these works. He works with Philip Miller, who's a contemporary composer from Johannesburg, and they work together to create soundtracks that sort of fit the feel of the images. Sometimes he'll use bits of Monteverdi and other classics that are out there. One of his earlier works, Shadow Procession, uses a street musician from Johannesburg and records his music, but sound is an important component, and so you'll get that fantastic composition by Philip Miller in this piece. And so here you see two stills from a piece where he's actually drawing his likeness, and then his likeness in the end transforms back into the artist himself. This is another view of that same room. And Day for Night is the other large piece shown at the short end of the room, and in this, you might have noticed in this piece and also in Day for Night, you see bits of moving particles that are actually ants. And apparently there was an ant infestation in Johannesburg at the time that this piece was being made, and Kentridge had a lot of ants in his studio, and he became a kind of ant wrangler. So he took advantage of the fact that there were these little critters all over the place and started pouring sugar water in particular designs, and the ants, of course, would gather. So what you're seeing here is actually the movement of ants, and they would form these beautiful designs that were evocative of galaxies and constellations, which is a motif from Kentridge's work. And then there will be moments where they'll scatter, and Kentridge said he would clap and they would all sort of scatter. What he did was he took the inverse of the film that he had taken, and so the black ants on white paper actually appear white on black as stars or constellations. And I added this is just a shot, trying to make this talk a little bit more than you'll see in the galleries. This is him at work in his actual studio during the filming of the piece that we just saw. It's a studio. He still lives in the house that he grew up in, magnificent house in the outskirts of Johannesburg, and he built a state-of-the-art studio on the property that has enormous ceiling heights, which enables him to film down on things and film up. So this is the fourth theme, the magic flute. This room is hard to miss. It's,
pardon me? Oh.
Yeah, it's again a rectangular room that has on each side two miniature theaters and then a chalkboard piece in the middle. That's this right here. And then the rest of the room on the walls, there are drawings related to the magic flute. So Kentridge has done a total of four operas so far in his career, a Monteverdi opera, Mozart's The Magic Flute, and most recently the Shostakovich's The Nose. And this room is really devoted to the magic flute. This piece in the middle actually kicked off his research and development of his ideas for the magic flute. So he was involved with, as he is with all of his operas, or the operas that he produces, he works with stage designers, costume designers, he does film projections, and so it really becomes a visual Kentridge experience. And so, but before an opera is actually produced, a wealth of work is created in the studio. It can be sculptural, it can be maquettes, it can be prints, it can be drawings, and as he teases out his ideas for both the sets and just the thinking and themes of the opera. So this particular piece, this whole room takes about 50 minutes in all to see, and I suggest that you really sit there when you have time. In fact, the whole exhibition has something on the order of 3 hours of viewing time in terms of moving images in these theater pieces, so I hope that you'll all go back and spend some time. At the top of the hour, this piece goes off. It's a blackboard that he had designed onto which a projection is projected, and again, dealing with like with the ants, instead of white, instead of black drawing on white sheets of paper, it's shown in the reverse, so you see white on black. That appears to be like chalk, but actually isn't made out of chalk. The Magic Flute, if some of you have seen it, it premiered, his production of it premiered in 2005. It came to BAM in Brooklyn in 2007. Some of you may have caught it or read about it then. And The Magic Flute deals with a lot of different themes, one of which is about the movement from irrationality and superstition to rationalism and the Enlightenment. There are figures, Queen of
Sarastro, right.
The Prince of Night and the Prince of...
Which one is which? I'm forgetting.
Two opposing figures, one to do with sun and knowledge and one to do with darkness and obscurity and irrationalism. And so he's dealing in these two characters, exploring the thematics of the opera and also the light and dark of his vision in that blackboard piece. This runs for about 8 minutes, and then this maquette runs for about 20-something minutes. And it is literally a maquette that he used to develop the scenery and his film projections for The Magic Flute. It's a little bit larger from what I understand than a typical theatrical maquette, but as you watch it, let's see, I think we have a... Oh, so here you see, this is the blackboard. This is another still image from it in a different location. And so you can see it's interesting, even the way he titles his works, learning the flute, this is educating himself about what he's going to be doing, preparing the flute. And this actually, what you see here is very close to what was used in the actual opera in terms of the scenery and the projections. And here you can see, it's not a particularly good, but you'll go upstairs. This also, it's a wonderful piece, and it has Mozart's overture. Both of these pieces do. And here I put in some stills from the actual opera itself, so you can see the blackboards were used. These are the projected images. And so again, it had, here, these are stairs that have blackboards. So all of these ideas that he was developing, in fact, inform the production. You can see the celestial sky. This is a piece, this is a print in the collection that again deals with staging and scenery from the Magic Flute. It's printed on 220 encyclopedia pages, quite a feat of printmaking. We show it at the back entrance, and it envelops the space in a similar way that the moving images envelop the opening space of the exhibition. The drawing in the collection, from a number of drawings that inform the work. The black box is the other theater piece, which is about the darker side of enlightenment. It actually didn't inform a live theatrical production, but it has to do with the colonization of Southwest Africa by the Germans and this terrible massacre in 1904 of the Herero people. And so it's more about the underside of enlightenment, or what so-called enlightenment can do. And it's wonderful. This is not at MoMA, but here you can see it's quite a contraption. He worked with specialists to build and design the computer program that runs actually all three pieces. And you can see this is a side view, and you can see they're not yet activated, but he's got these fantastic mechanical puppets or figures that come out into the space. This is a very blurry rendering of one and two of the mechanical figures. The last theme, the nose, is related to his most recent production. And again, this is a room in the round that has, I think, 1, 2, 3, 4, something on the order of 7 different projections in which he's teasing out his ideas for the opera, the scenery, the setting. Some of what's shown in here was actually used, or variations of it were used in the opera. These are stills of some of the film projections in that room. So you can see that's Shostakovich across from a nose. This is another kind of procession with Russian letters that spells out cinema. This is the nose climbing the stairs, similar to these steps that he has in his studio. The nose is this absurdist story that he became very interested in, which is about a Russian bureaucrat that loses his nose. He wakes up one morning and the nose is gone. And then that nose actually is running around St. Petersburg doing high society activities and assumes greater clout than the original bureaucrat. Eventually the nose returns to the face, but it's this kind of absurdist satirical story that really interested Kentridge in exploring Russian history and totalitarianism. These are a couple of terrible reproductions of a couple of collaged prints that we have. Etchings that he did related to the nose, so again, teasing out the storyline in so many different mediums. And he, last but not least, also did a live theatrical performance, which is really a kind of monologue performance with again, the stepladder and film projections behind him, in which he talked about the ideas behind the nose and the creative process for him. And it was a wonderful performance that he has performed, I think, over 14 times worldwide. He performed it the night before the nose premiered here in New York. And two more stills. So that sort of brings you, these are just some other images that I found when we had requested images from the studio of him working on the nose. And so you can see here, these are not published, but this is actually the maquette for the nose, and so in fact, the production at the Met did very much resemble this. I don't know if he's going to make an artwork out of it or if it's just going to exist as a working thing in his studio, but here you can see he's working with set designers and costume designers. and another shot of his studio as he works on playing with the projections. So I think I'd like to open. I've been talking long enough. Are there any questions about the work, the installation, any of the particular mediums? Yes. Right. So he, on the one hand, when he works on his drawings, he's very much alone, the sort of lone artist working on drawings. But he's in so many of these other works, he works in a very collaborative manner, whether he's working in a print workshop with a master printer, he's working with a sound technician, a composer. He had people come in to construct these particular theaters. He has studio assistants. So it's very much a collaborative effort. I mean, there's no question that he's the driving force, but and he acknowledges, if you see all the labels in the exhibition, credit all the different people who worked on his... Yeah.
Did you do the costumes as well?
He did the costumes, and he worked with a costume designer. Yep. Oh, thank you. I'm happy to take more questions.
I'm just curious because I had seen his tapestries.
Yes. The tapestries are, he's also worked with in tapestries, large-scale tapestries. Some have been shown at Marion Goodman Gallery. The Philadelphia Museum of Art did a major exhibition and catalog. It's just another means through which he's exploring his imagery. He does work with an incredible workshop of weavers in South Africa, and so what's nice is a lot of work comes out of those projects for the community locally. We've never shown them here. I mean, if we certainly can't show every medium that he's worked in, and some I think are stronger than others, so they're not included in this exhibition.
Did he actually write the opera?
No, it's a Shostakovich opera that was performed in 1930 based on Nikolai Gogol short story that was written in 1836. So no, it was just his, I mean, all, you know, unless there's a new entirely.
Work, the scenery,
exactly,
staging.
All the staging, the direction, and all of the visual components. Yes.
Mm-hmm. How does this work itself in South Africa?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, there's no question that he's, in some ways, South Africa's poster boy. I mean, he sort of came onto the international scene in the late 90s with Documenta, which is a major international exhibition that occurs in Kassel, Germany. And it was at that point that the work really began to be shown internationally. Museums became interested, galleries became interested. For a long time, you know, there was an embargo. There were South Africa was very much isolated economically, politically, artistically, culturally during apartheid. And then in the 90s, things started to open up. He always traveled, and so, you know, he had the ability and means to exhibit in an international way that other artists couldn't. I think that he has done a, I think he's viewed very positively. He's opened the door. He's brought a lot of interest to South Africa. And now, of course, there are so many other artists working in South Africa who have left South Africa and are working in Europe and so on, who have also gained great notoriety. I think he was the first, there's no question, he and David Goldblatt, but there are many, many others who have followed. Yeah. Yes?
In Stone Age animation, do you know how many shots he needs to take for 1 minute of video?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know the answer. I think it's something on the order of hundreds to complete a whole film. I don't know the answer, but I do know on MoMA's website we do discuss that. I'm not sure. What I can tell you is something on the order of 20 drawings comprise an entire film animation. So in other words, he'll take one drawing and rework it and photograph it however many times. And then when there's a major scene change, he'll start a new drawing. So something around 20 drawings, give or take, depending upon the length of a particular film animation comprise. And then each of those drawings goes through so many different stages. Yep.
You were talking earlier about having two spaces within the museum for mm-hmm. installation. How did Tim Burton possibly end up with such a small space?
Well, I wasn't the curator, so I can't answer that. But I will say that, Tim Burton is a kind of crossover figure. He's an artist. He's filmmaker, he's a Hollywood figure, so I think at MoMA's got a film department, we have a strong history of showing and champion filmmakers. Some of it has to do with scheduling, some of it has to do with other priorities that are on the calendar. In fact, it's more of a coincidence of scheduling that Kentridge got the second floor. In fact, it normally would have been a sixth floor exhibition gallery. Rarely do we give the second gallery over to one artist. The last time we did it was to Richard Serra, and that's because we can't fit his, in fact, that floor was designed specifically to hold and house Richard Serra works. So we gave that floor to Richard Serra. Otherwise it's shown, it's devoted to the contemporary collection. We wanted early on to work with the Metropolitan Opera to have the exhibition here coincide with the premiere of the Nose Opera, and I think it was a much richer experience citywide and viewer-wide because of it, but our sixth floor was not available, and so we used the second floor. One of the rationales was also the fact that more than half of the works are actually from the collection, so there was a collection component to it, but there's no doubt that it's been a controversial thing that we've given him this much space. I think it was to his, to the benefit of the exhibition overall, and I think the work is worthy of it, and certainly the crowds are filling the space. It's a combination of things. I think Tim Burton isn't someone who's, I don't know, you have to ask the Tim Burton curator, but it's a combination of things. Yeah. Well, he was always involved in theater. As I mentioned, he actually studied theater. You know, he was in African studies and poli-sci major in college. He was exploring theater. He was an actor. He designed stage sets in the 70s. He printed posters for theater. Then he started getting into the visual arts. So theater has been there throughout, and he's done a number of, he's done three operas, but he's done a number of far more. I don't know how many. But collaborations with the Handspring Puppet Company, which is a wonderful theater group out of Johannesburg that uses puppetry and live characters. And so he's done a number of collaborations with them. Opera, I don't know what precipitated the invitation. He was probably invited or commissioned to do. It was Monteverdi's Return, The Return of Ulysses, and then the Magic Flute Commission came, and then of course the Nose is being the biggest.
So was that was my next follow up question was, whose project sort of got greenlit at first, the Metropolitan Opera or MoMA's exhibition, or was it just sort of?
It sort of happened at the same time. I mean, we had been thinking about Kentridge because of the commitment we've made to his work through our collection. We were thinking actually of doing our own independent exhibition when we learned that he was going to premiere the opera here at the Met. But then we learned that another exhibition was being curated by Mark Rosenthal for SF MoMA, and that they were probably going to want to send that show to the East Coast. And so we decided, instead of working on our own project, to work with Mark and take his show, but fashion it for our space and interject it with a lot of collection work. So the conversations started years and years ago between Mark Rosenthal, MoMA, and Peter Gelb's office at the Met.
Does MoMA own the accordion?
We do, yeah. It's an extraordinary work.
Did I see that at the Met? I know I've seen it before here.
Yeah, we've shown it here before, yeah. Actually in our print gallery, and the Met Museum did an exhibition several years ago in one of their mezzanine galleries that focused on prints and drawings. I don't know if they had it there. They had one of the large linoleum cuts, several of the drawings, one of his film animations, tide table. I don't know if they... It could be. I'm not sure if they own it or not. What was interesting about that work is in this exhibition, I decided to show it standing up so you could actually read the procession. In the other venues, it was shown flat like a book, and so of course you approached it like a book, which was nice, but you couldn't read the procession in the same way, so that was a change that I think benefited. Anything else? Thank you for your interest.